5. Can't make the food contest, Helen. Stomach's upset. I'll fix you, Ubik. Ubik drops you back in the thick of things fast. Taken as directed, Ubik speeds relief to head and stomach. Remember, Ubik is only seconds away. Avoid prolonged use. During the long days of forced unnatural idleness, the anti-telepath Tippy Jackson slept regularly until noon. An electrode planted within her brain perpetually stimulated EREM, extremely rapid eye movement, sleep, so while tucked within the percale sheets of her bed, she had plenty to do. At this particular moment, her artificially induced dream state centered around the mythical Hollis functionary endowed with enormous psionic powers. Every other inertial in the Sol system had either given up or been melted down into lard. By process of elimination, the task of nullifying the field generated by this supernatural entity had devolved to her.
"I can't be myself while you're around," her nebulous opponent informed her.
On his face, a feral, hateful expression formed, giving him the appearance of a psychotic squirrel. In her dream, Tippy answered, "Perhaps your definition of your self-system lacks authentic boundaries. You've erected a precarious structure of personality on unconscious factors of which you have no control. That's why you feel threatened by me."
"Aren't you an employee of a prudence organization?"
the Hollis telepath demanded, looking nervously about. "If you're the stupendous talent you claim to be," Tippy said, "you can tell that by reading my mind."
"I can't read anybody's mind," the telepath said. "My talent is gone. I'll let you talk to my brother, Bill. Here, Bill, talk to this lady. Do you like this lady?"
Bill, looking more or less like his brother, the telepath, said, "I like her fine because I'm a precog and she doesn't proscript me." He shuffled his feet and grinned, revealing great pale teeth as blunt as shovels.
"I, that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature—"
He paused, wrinkling his forehead.
"How does it go, Matt?" he asked his brother. "Deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up,"
Matt, the squirrel-like telepath, said, scratching meditatively at his pelt.
"Oh, yeah," Bill the precog nodded. "I remember. And that so lingly and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them."
"From Richard III, he explained to Tippy. Both brothers grinned. Even their incisors were blunt, as if they lived on a diet of uncooked seeds. Tippy said, "What does that mean?"
"It means," both Matt and Bill said in unison, "that we're gonna get you."
The vidphone rang, waking Tippy up. Stumbling groggily to it, confounded by floating colored bubbles, blinking, she lifted the receiver and said, "Hello?" "God, it's late," she thought, seeing the clock. "I'm turning into a vegetable." Glenn Runciter's face emerged on the screen. "Hello, Mr. Runciter," she said, standing out of sight of the phone scanner. "Has a job turned up for me?"
"Ah, Miss Jackson," Runciter said, "I'm glad I caught you. A group is forming under Joe Chips in my direction. 11 in all. A major work assignment for those we choose. We've been examining everyone's history, and Joe thinks yours looks good, and I tend to agree. How long will it take you to get down here?"
His tone seemed adequately optimistic, but on the little screen his face looked hard-pressed and careworn. Tippy said, "For this one, will I be living?"
"Yes, you'll have to pack," chidingly, he said. "We're supposed to be packed and ready to go at all times. That's a rule I don't ever want broken, especially in a case like this where there's a time factor."
"I am packed. I'll be at the New York office in 15 minutes. All I have to do is leave a note for my husband, who's at work."
"Well, okay,"
Runciter said, looking preoccupied. He was probably already reading the next name on his list.
"Goodbye, Miss Jackson."
He rang off. That was a strange dream, she thought, as she hastily unbuttoned her pajamas and hurried back into the bedroom for her clothes. What did Bill and Matt say that poetry was from? Richard III, she remembered, seeing in her mind once more their flat, big teeth, their unformed, knob-like, identical heads with tufts of reddish hair growing from them like patches of weeds. "I don't think I've ever read Richard III," she realized. "Or if I did, it must have been years ago when I was a child." "How can you dream lines of poetry you don't know?" she asked herself. Maybe an actual non-dream telepath was getting at me while I slept, or a telepath and a precog working together, the way I saw them in my dream. It might be a good idea to ask our research department whether Hollis does, by any remote chance, employ a brother team named Matt and Bill. Puzzled and uneasy, she began as quickly as possible to dress. Lighting a green all-Havana Cuesta Rey Palma Supreme, Glenn Runciter leaned back in his noble chair, pressed a button of his intercom, and said,
"Make out a bounty check, Mrs. Frick, payable to G.G. Ashwood for 100 poscreds."
"Yes, Mr. Runciter."
He watched G.G. Ashwood, who paced with manic restlessness about the big office with its genuine hardwood floor, against which G.G.'s feet clacked irritatingly.
"Joe Chip can't seem to tell me what she does," Runciter said.
"Joe Chip is a grunk," Gigi said.
"How come she, this Pat, can travel back into time and no one else can? I'll bet this talent isn't new. You scouts probably just missed noticing it up till now. Anyhow, it's not logical for a prudence organization to hire her. It's a talent, not an anti-talent. We deal in—"
"As I explained, and as Joe indicated on the test report, it aborts the precogs out of business."
"But that's only a side effect," Runciter pondered moodily. "Joe thinks she's dangerous. I don't know why."
"Did you ask him why?"
Runciter said.
"He mumbled the way he always does. Joe never has reasons, just hunches. On the other hand, he wants to include her in the Mick operation."
He shuffled through, rooted among, and rearranged the personnel department documents before him on his desk.
"Ask Joe to come in here so we can see if we've got our group of 11 set up."
He examined his watch.
"They should be arriving about now. I'm going to tell Joe to his face that he's crazy to include this Pat Conley girl if she's so dangerous. Wouldn't you say, Gigi?"
Gigi Ashwood said,
"He's got a thing going with her."
"What sort of thing?"
"A sexual understanding."
"Joe has no sexual understanding. Nina Freed read his mind the other day, and he's too poor even to—"
He broke off because the office door had opened. Mrs. Frick teetered her way in, carrying Gigi's bounty check for him to sign.
"I know why he wants her along on the Mick operation," Runciter said as he scratched his signature on the check. "So he can keep an eye on her. He's going, too. He's going to measure the psi field despite what the client stipulated. We have to know what we're up against. Thank you, Ms. Frick."
He waved her away and held the check out to G.G. Ashwood.
"Suppose we don't measure the psi field and it turns out to be too intense for our inertials. Who gets blamed?"
"We do," G.G. said.
"I told them 11 wasn't enough. We're supplying our best. We're doing the best we can. After all, getting Stanton Mick's patronage is a matter of great importance to us. Amazing that someone as wealthy and powerful as Mick could be so short-sighted, so goddamn miserly. Ms. Frick, is Joe out there, Joe Chip?"
Mrs. Frick said,
"Mr. Chip is in the outer office with a number of other people."
"How many other people, Ms. Frick, 10 or 11?
"I'd say about that many, Mr. Runciter, give or take one or two."
To G.G. Ashwood, Runciter said, "That's the group. I want to see them, all of them, together before they leave for Luna."
To Mrs. Frick, he said,
"Send them in."
He puffed vigorously on his green-wrapped cigar. She gyrated out.
"We know," Runciter said to G.G., "that as individuals they perform well. It's all down here on paper."
He rattled the documents on his desk.
"But how about together? How great a polyencephalic counterfield will they generate together? Ask yourself that, Gigi. That is the question to ask."
"I guess time will tell,"
Gigi Ashwood said.
"I've been in this business a long time," Runciter said.
From the outer office, people began to file in.
"This is my contribution to contemporary civilization."
"That puts it well," Gigi said. "You're a policeman guarding human privacy."
"You know what Ray Hollis says about us?"
Runciter said.
"He says we're trying to turn the clock back."
He eyed the individuals who had begun to fill up his office. They gathered near one another, none of them speaking. They waited for him. "What an ill-assorted bunch," he thought pessimistically. A young string bean of a girl with glasses and straight lemon-yellow hair, wearing a cowboy hat, black lace mantilla, and Bermuda shorts, that would be Edie Dorn. A good-looking, older, dark woman with tricky, deranged eyes who wore a silk sari and nylon obi and bobby socks. Francie something. A part-time schizophrenic who imagined that sentient beings from Beetlejuice occasionally landed on the roof of her Conap building. A woolly-haired adolescent boy wrapped in a superior and cynical cloud of pride, this one in a floral muumuu and spandex bloomers Runciter had never encountered before. And so it went. Five females and, he counted, five males. Someone was missing. Ahead of Joe Chip, the smoldering, brooding girl, Patricia Conley, entered. That made the 11th. The group had all appeared.
"You made good time, Mrs. Jackson," he said to the mannish, 30-ish, sand-colored lady wearing ersatz vicuña trousers and a gray sweatshirt, on which had been printed a now-faded full-face portrait of Bertrand Lord Russell. "You had less time than anybody else, inasmuch as I notified you last."
Tippy Jackson smiled a bloodless, sand-colored smile.
"Some of you, I know," Runciter said, rising from his chair and indicating with his hands that they should find chairs and make themselves comfortable, smoking, if necessary. "You, Miss Dorn, Mr. Chip and I chose you first because of your top-notch activity vis-à-vis S. Dole Melipone, whom you eventually lost through no fault of your own."
"Thank you, Mr. Runciter,"
Edie Dorn said in a wispy, shy trickle of a voice. She blushed and stared wide-eyed at the far wall.
"It's good to be a part of this new undertaking," she added with undernourished conviction.
"Which one of you is Al Hammond?"
Runciter asked, consulting his documents.
An excessively tall, stoop-shouldered Negro with a gentle expression on his elongated face made a motion to indicate himself. "I've never met you before," Runciter said, reading the material from Al Hammond's file. "You rate highest among our anti-precogs. I should, of course, have gotten around to meeting you. How many of the rest of you are anti-precog?"
Three additional hands appeared.
"The four of you," Runciter said, "will undoubtedly get a great bloop out of meeting and working with G.G. Ashwood's most recent discovery, who aborts precogs on a new basis. Perhaps Ms. Conley herself will describe it to us."
He nodded toward Pat.
"And found himself standing before a shop window on Fifth Avenue, a rare coin shop. He was studying an uncirculated U.S. gold dollar and wondering if he could afford to add it to his collection." "What collection?" he asked himself, startled. "I don't collect coins. What am I doing here? And how long have I been wandering around window shopping when I ought to be in my office supervising?" He could not remember what he generally supervised. A business of some kind, dealing in people with ability, special talents. He shut his eyes, trying to focus his mind. "No, I had to give that up," he realized. "Because of a coronary last year, I had to retire. But I was just there," he remembered, "only a few seconds ago, in my office, talking to a group of people about a new project." He shut his eyes. "It's gone," he thought dazedly. "Everything I built up."
When he opened his eyes, he found himself back in his office. He faced G.G. Ashwood, Joe Chip, and a dark, intensely attractive girl whose name he did not recall. Other than that, his office was empty, which, for reasons he did not understand, struck him as strange.
"Mr. Runciter," Joe Chip said, "I'd like you to meet Patricia Conley."
The girl said,
"How nice to be introduced to you at last, Mr. Runciter."
She laughed, and her eyes flashed exultantly. Runciter did not know why. Joe Chip realized she's been doing something.
"Pat," he said aloud, "I can't put my finger on it, but things are different."
He gazed wonderingly around the office. It appeared as it had always, too loud a carpet, too many unrelated art objects, on the walls, original pictures of no artistic merit whatever. Glenn Runciter had not changed. Shaggy and gray, his face wrinkled broodingly, he returned Joe's stare. He seemed too perplexed. Over by the window, G.G. Ashwood, wearing his customary natty birch-bark pantaloons, hemp-rope belt, peekaboo see-through top, and train engineer's tall hat, shrugged indifferently. He obviously saw nothing wrong.
"Nothing is different," Pat said.
Everything is different, Joe said to her. You must have gone back into time and put us on a different track. I can't prove it, and I can't specify the nature of the changes.
No domestic quarreling on my time, Runciter said, frowningly.
Joe, taken aback, said, domestic quarreling? He saw then on Pat's finger the ring, wrought silver and jade. He remembered helping her pick it out, 2 days, he thought, before we got married. That was over a year ago, despite how bad off I was financially. That, of course, is changed now. Pat, with her salary and her money-minding propensity, fixed that for all time.
Anyhow, to continue, Runciter said, we must each of us ask ourselves why Stanton Mick took his business to a prudence organization other than ours. Logically, we should have gotten a contract. We're the finest in the business, and we're located in New York, where Mick generally prefers to deal. Do you have any theory, Mrs. Chip? He looked hopefully in Pat's direction.
Pat said, do you really want to know, Mr. Runciter?
Yes, he nodded vigorously. I'd very much like to know.
I did it, Pat said.
How?
With my talent.
Runciter said, what talent? You don't have a talent. You're Joe Chip's wife.
At the window, G.G. Ashwood said,
you came in here to meet Joe and me for lunch.
She has a talent, Joe said.
He tried to remember, but already it had become foggy. The memory dimmed, even as he tried to resurrect it. A different time track, he thought. The past.
Other than that, he could not make it out. There, the memory ended.
My wife, he thought, is unique. She can do something no one else on Earth can do. In that case, why isn't she working for Runciter Associates? Something is wrong.
Have you measured it?
Runciter asked him.
I mean, that's your job. You sound as if you have. You sound sure of yourself.
I'm not sure of myself, Joe said. But I am sure about my wife, he said to himself.
I'll get my test gear, he said, and we'll see what sort of a feel she creates. Oh, come on, Joe,
Runciter said angrily.
If your wife has a talent or an anti-talent, you would have measured it at least a year ago. You wouldn't be discovering it now.
He pressed a button on his desk intercom.
Personnel, do we have a file on Mrs. Chip, Patricia Chip?
After a pause, the intercom said,
no file on Mrs. Chip, under her maiden name, perhaps?
Conley, Joe said. Patricia Conley. Again, a pause.
On a Miss Patricia Conley, we have 2 items, an initial scout report by Mr. Ashwood, and then test findings by Mr. Chip.
From the slot of the intercom, repros of the 2 documents slowly dribbled forth and dropped to the surface of the desk.
Examining Joe Chip's findings, Runciter said, scowling, Joe, you better look at this. Come here.
He jabbed a finger at the page, and Joe, coming over beside him, saw the 2 underlined crosses. He and Runciter glanced at each other, then at Pat.
I know what it reads, Pat said, levelly. Unbelievable power, anti-psi field unique in scope.
She concentrated, trying visibly to remember the exact wording. Can probably...
We did get the Mick contract, Runciter said to Joe Chip. I had a group of 11 inertials in here, and then I suggested to her...
Joe said... That she show the group what she could do, so she did. She did exactly that, and my evaluation was right. With his fingertip, he traced the symbols of danger at the bottom of the sheet.
My own wife, he said.
I'm not your wife, Pat said. I changed that, too. Do you want to go back the way it was? With no changes, not even in details? That won't show your inertials much. On the other hand, they're unaware, anyhow, unless some of them have retained a vestigial memory, as Joe has. By now, though, it should have phased out.
Runciter said bitingly,
I'd like the Mick contract back, that much at least.
When I scout them, G.G. Ashwood said, I scout them.
He had become gray.
Yes, you really bring in the talent, Runciter said.
The intercom buzzed, and the quaking elderly voice of Mrs. Frick rasped,
A group of our inertials are waiting to see you, Mr. Runciter. They say you sent for them in connection with a new joint work project. Are you free to see them?
Send them in, Runciter said.
Pat said, I'll keep this ring. She displayed the silver and jade wedding ring, which in another time track she and Joe had picked out. This much of the alternate world she had elected to retain. He wondered what, if any, legal basis she had kept in addition. None, he hoped. Wisely, however, he said nothing, better not even to ask. The office door opened, and in pairs the inertials entered. They stood uncertainly for a moment, and then began seating themselves, facing Runciter's desk. Runciter eyed them, then pawed among the rat's nest of documents on his desk. Obviously, he was trying to determine whether Pat had changed in any way the composition of the group.
"Edie Dorn,"
Runciter said. "Yes, you're here." He glanced at her, then at the man beside her.
"Hammond? Okay, Hammond. Tippy Jackson?"
He peered inquiringly. "I made it as quick as I could," Mrs. Jackson said. "You didn't give me much time, Mr. Runciter."
"John Ild?" Runciter said.
The adolescent boy with the tousled woolly hair grunted in response. His arrogance, Joan noted, seemed to have receded. The boy now seemed introverted and even a little shaken. It would be interesting, Joe thought, to find out what he remembers. What all of them, individually and collectively, remember.
"Francesca Spanish," Runciter said.
The luminous, gypsy-like dark woman radiating a peculiar jangled tautness spoke up.
"During the last few minutes, Mr. Runciter, while we waited in your outer office, mysterious voices appeared to me and told me things."
"You're Francesca Spanish?"
Runciter asked her patiently. He looked more than usually tired.
"I am. I have always been. I will always be."
Miss Spanish's voice rang with conviction.
"May I tell you what the voices revealed to me?"
"Possibly later,"
Runciter said, passing on to the next personnel document.
"It must be said,"
Miss Spanish declared vibrantly.
"All right," Runciter said. "We'll take a break for a couple of minutes."
He opened a drawer of his desk, got out one of his amphetamine tablets, took it without water.
"Let's hear what the voices revealed to you, Miss Spanish."
He glanced toward Joe, shrugging.
"Someone," Miss Spanish said, "just now moved us, all of us, into another world. We inhabited it, lived in it, as citizens of it, and then a vast, all-encompassing spiritual agency restored us to this, our rightful universe."
"That would be Pat," Joe Chip said, "Pat Conley, who just joined the firm today." "Tito Apostos," Runciter said, "you're here?"
He craned his neck, peering about the room at the seated people.
A bald-headed man, wagging a goatish beard, pointed to himself. He wore old-fashioned, hip-hugging gold lamé trousers, yet somehow created a stylish effect.
Perhaps the egg-sized buttons of his kelp-green midi blouse helped. In any case, he exuded a grand dignity, a loftiness surpassing the average. Joe felt impressed.
"Don Denny," Runciter said.
"Right here, sir,"
a confident baritone like that of a Siamese cat declared. It arose from within a slender, earnest-looking individual who sat bolt upright in his chair, his hands on his knees. He wore a polyester dirndl, his long hair in a snood, cowboy chaps with simulated silver stars, and sandals.
"You're an anti-animator," Runciter said, reading the appropriate sheet, "the only one we use."
To Joe, he said, "I wonder if we'll need him. Maybe we should substitute another anti-telepath. The more of those, the better." Joe said, "We have to cover everything, since we don't know what we're getting into."
"I guess so,"
Runciter nodded.
"Okay, Sammy Mundo."
A weak-nosed young man, dressed in a maxi skirt with an undersized melon-like head, stuck his hand up in a spasmodic, wobbling tick-like gesture, as if Joe thought the anemic body had done it by itself. He knew this particular person.
Mundo looked years younger than his chronological age. Both mental and physical growth processes had ceased for him long ago. Technically, Mundo had the intelligence of a raccoon. He could walk, eat, bathe himself, even, after a fashion, talk. His anti-telepathic ability, however, was considerable. Once alone, he had blanked out S. Dol Melipone. The firm's house magazine had rambled on about it for months afterward.
"Oh, yes," Runciter said. "Now we come to Wendy Wright."
As always, when the opportunity arose, Joe took a long, astute look. at the girl whom, if he could have managed it, he would have had as his mistress, or even better, his wife. It did not seem possible that Wendy Wright had been born out of blood and internal organs like other people. In proximity to her, he felt himself to be a squat, oily, sweating, uneducated nurt, whose stomach rattled and whose breath wheezed. Near her, he became aware of the physical mechanisms which kept him alive. Within him, machinery, pipes and valves and gas compressors and fan belts had to chug away at a losing task, a labor ultimately doomed. Seeing her face, he discovered that his own consisted of a garish mask. Noticing her body made him feel like a low-class wind-up toy. All her colors possessed a subtle quality, indirectly lit. Her eyes, those green and tumbled stones, looked impassively at everything. He had never seen fear in them, or aversion, or contempt. What she saw, she accepted. Generally, she seemed calm, but more than that, she struck him as being durable, untroubled and cool, not subject to wear or to fatigue or to physical illness and decline. Probably she was 25 or 26, but he could not imagine her looking younger, and certainly she would never look older. She had too much control over herself and outside reality for that. "I'm here," Wendy said with soft tranquility.
Runciter nodded. "Okay, that leaves Fred Zafsky."
He fixed his gaze on a flabby, big-footed, middle-aged, unnatural-looking individual, with pasted-down hair, muddy skin, plus a peculiar protruding Adam's apple, clad for this occasion in a shift dress the color of a baboon's ass. "That must be you."
"Right you are," Zafsky agreed and snickered. "How about that?"
"Christ," Runciter said, shaking his head.
"Well, we have to include one anti-parakineticist to be safe, and you're it."
He tossed down his documents and looked about for his green cigar. To Joe, he said,
"That's the group, plus you and me. Any last-minute changes you want to make?"
"I'm satisfied," Joe said.
"You suppose this bunch of inertials is the best combination we can come up with?"
Runciter eyed him intently.
"Yes," Joe said. "And it's good enough to take on Hollis's size?"
"Yes," Joe said. But he knew otherwise. It was not something he could put his finger on. It certainly was not rational. Potentially, the counterfield capacity of the 11 inertials had to be considered enormous, and yet—
"Mr. Chip, can I have a second of your time?"
Mr. Apostos, bald-headed and bearded, his gold lamé trousers glittering, plucked at Joe Chip's arm.
"Could I discuss an experience I had late last night? In a hypnagogic state, I seem to have contacted one or possibly two of Mr. Hollis's people. A telepath, evidently operating in conjunction with one of their precogs. Do you think I should tell Mr. Runciter? Is it important?"
Hesitating, Joe Chip looked toward Runciter. Seated in his worthy beloved chair, trying to relight his all-Havana cigar, Runciter appeared terribly tired. The wattles of his face sagged.
"No,"
Joe said. "Let it go."
"Ladies and gentlemen," Runciter said, raising his voice above the general noise, "we're leaving now for Luna. You 11 inertials, Joe Chip and myself, and our client's rep, Zoe Wirt. 14 of us in all. We'll use our own ship."
He got out his round, gold, anachronistic pocket watch and studied it.
3:30. Pratfall 2 will take off from the main roof field at 4.
He snapped his watch shut and returned it to the pocket of his silk sash.
"Well, Joe," he said, "we're in this, for better or worse. I wish we had a resident precog who could take a look ahead for us."
Both his face and the tone of his voice drooped with worry and the cares, the irreversible burden of responsibility and age.